Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
General Joseph Dunford, the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says he plans to do his part to respond to congressional criticism over ballooning bureaucracies within the Defense Department. As Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu reports, Dunford intends to start trimming some of the functions of the Joint Chiefs Staff within the next few weeks.
Dunford hasn't specified which of the Joint Staff's jobs he thinks the Defense Department could live without, but speaking to a forum hosted by the Center for a New American Security earlier this month, he made clear he believes some of his staff overlaps with similar work being done in the Office of the Secretary of Defense and in the military services. He says he'll likely begin discussing which staff functions to cut after the first of the year.
And I want to do this right, and probably will do this sometime after the first year, where I can actually look at people and say, look, it isn't what you're doing. You're doing a great job, but we're going to divest ourselves of these functions, because the Joint Staff over time, for a variety of reasons, has begun to do things that I think we can probably walk away from. I will tell you, my priority for the Joint Staff is to focus on the strategy, is to focus on supporting the combatant commanders, so it's force development, capability development, joint force readiness, those core areas.
Dunford says the changes will mean that the Joint Chiefs, as an institution, will pay relatively little attention to policy matters that are better left at OSD and the military departments, such as how to man, train, and equip the individual military services.
To date, I have not had a meeting with the Joint Chiefs on what I would describe as a Title 10 issue. And I don't intend on doing that except in very extraordinary cases. So I'll give you an example. Pay raise. The pay raise came up, and I provided my input as to what I thought the pay raise would be. And I talked to the Chiefs, and I say, look, if you all think we need a Joint Chiefs position on the pay raise, that's fine, but you have a vehicle to provide your input through your service chief, that through your service secretary, that then goes to the Secretary of Defense. So, you know, unless there's an extraordinary reason for what I call a Title 10 issue, we won't have Joint Chiefs positions. In my mind, we'll spend our time establishing positions on the current fight against ISIL, what our way ahead ought to be in Afghanistan, but the demands of the Joint Chiefs have been driven by others, and so they said, well, we want a Joint Chiefs position on this or that. Well, that requires a staff to actually help the chairman to form a position, and those are some of the things that have happened over time. But I am, despite the fact that people will say the organization isn't capable of making changes itself, in terms of using the principle of alignment in divesting ourselves of things that we don't think we need to do that are then, you know, either duplicated up in OSD or down in the service secretaries, I'm all in favor of doing that.
Currently, the Joint Staff is made up of nearly 4,000 military members and DOD civilians. About half of the current workforce was absorbed into the organization in 2011 when the military closed its Joint Forces Command in Suffolk, Virginia, and moved all but 300 of JFCOM's positions into the Joint Staff. Critics, including Senator John McCain, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, have seized on that example as emblematic of the fact that DOD never actually downsizes its headquarters staffs. It simply moves the positions to other organizations. During recent hearings McCain has hosted in the run-up to potential DOD reform legislation, several defense experts have pointed to similar bloat in the military's combatant commands and pointed out that most modern military operations are now overseen by single-purpose joint task forces, not the COCOMs. But Dunford says he would urge caution before diminishing the combatant commands' role.
What I don't want us to do, and I'm willing to take a hard look at this, war game it, and be critical in our thinking about it, but I don't want us to take the last 14 years of what we have described as war, and it has been war, and then project that out for the next 15 or 20 years. We need to make sure that when we talk about what the combatant commanders do or don't do, we talk about what they will do or don't do across the range of military operations, and not just narrowly focused in the fight against ISIL, where we have concluded that joint task forces solve all the problems for the combatant commander. I don't believe that's the case. And if you think about trans-regional, multi-domain, and multifunctional, I don't know how we'll call somebody at the four-star level that's responsible for a geographic command anything other than a warfighter. That doesn't mean we can't make some changes in our unified command plan. It doesn't mean all the combatant commanders commands have to exist in their current form. It doesn't mean the Joint Staff has to exist in its current form. I just want to make sure that we have the right framework within which to make recommendations and to have a debate, and we don't just take the last 14 years and say, well, aha, This is what they've been doing for the last 14 years, so automatically that's what they'll be doing over the next 15 to 20 years.
Nonetheless, Dunford says he's not philosophically opposed to shrinking the staff size of any military organization. He says bigger is not always better.
I am now growing into the staff that I have. You know, I was much happier as a colonel where I actually knew everybody on my staff. And honestly, you have a personal relationship with them and you move at the speed of heat. And when you have a larger staff, it's much more difficult to convey your intent. It's much more difficult to come up with a process within which you can make decisions, frame decisions, and make decisions. It's much harder to have a big staff. So I think most of us would instinctively want to have a smaller staff. It's just got to be aligned to the functions that have to be performed. And I think that's the work that we have to do really pretty quickly because Senator McCain's running pretty hard.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I have an obligation. I have an obligation to provide best military advice and inform that dialogue. It doesn't mean, as in the case of Goldwater Nichols, the department's position at that time wasn't accepted. I like to think right now that we're willing to be as innovative as anybody else is. It doesn't mean that we'll have all the good ideas, but I certainly will be receptive to those. And I'm not fighting to hang on to what we have today. I just want to make sure that we spend 80% of our time trying to solve the problem for tomorrow, and then 20% of our time developing the wire diagram and talking about how big we ought to be. You know, that would be my only appeal, really, in this debate is to do that.
In Washington, Jared Serbu, FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM.
Share this interview with colleagues. Go to FederalNewsRadio.com/FederalDrive and click Share with Friends.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages. Listening to Pentagon Solutions on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
When the Navy buys a battleship, it wants two basic qualities. Lethality, can it find and reliably destroy enemy targets? And survivability, can it take a lick and keep on ticking? The Troubled Littoral Combat Ship program has had ongoing questions about its lethality and survivability. 6 years after delivery of the first LCS, the Navy isn't quite sure whether it's bought a battleship or a cruise ship. For the latest, we turn to Michelle Mackin, Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Management at the Government Accountability Office. Michelle, great to have you back.
Thank you.
You have recommended that the Navy look carefully and maybe hold back some of the money for the LCS program in 2016. Tell us why.
We've actually recommended for the past several years that the Navy slow down the pace of procurement of these ships, primarily because key important testing has not been completed and the results haven't been assessed. And that testing pertains to lethality as well as the survivability of the ship. Until this last most recent report, DOD had largely disagreed with our recommendations, but this time they did largely agree.
And so they've got a few of these already built and in operation, right? What does the fleet look like at this point?
Well, there are actually 26 of the ships already either constructed, delivered, or under contract, which is a large quantity, and that's why we had expressed some concern about that over time.
Now, on the survivability front, that is, can it take, I guess, shots, and you know, how well can it survive an actual battle situation? Isn't that something you would have expected the Navy to thoroughly test before putting anybody aboard and sending them out on missions?
Frankly, yes, we would. There are key tests there, including full ship shock trials, where the ships are subjected to an underwater explosion and testers assess the damage. Those tests have not been conducted on either of the two variants. Another key example is the Independence variant. That's the aluminum hull trimaran ship. Its vulnerability to attacks, i.e. survivability, has not been fully tested.
All right, and let's switch over for a moment to lethality, because my understanding of the LCS is that it's not just one ship, but that they can change what goes onto the top of it, depending on the mission. And so they have these modules for different purposes. How does that relate to this whole lethality question?
That's right. There are mission module packages, one being for surface warfare, which would be the primary lethality requirement. again, more operational tests are still needed to demonstrate that both variants can meet the surface warfare requirements of the ship. This includes, for example, the ship's ability to defeat the required number of incoming fast attack craft. And the LCS won't have demonstrated its lethality requirements for several years. One key point there is that the Navy needs to install and test the Longbow Hellfire missiles with the surface warfare mission package, and that missile system hasn't been integrated onto the ships yet, and there are actually concerns about the weight of that missile system.
So in other words, the issue here is that there is a proven weapon system, the Hellfire, and I guess the Navy has a couple of dozen different shipboard firing systems that fire different things, but it has to be, each one has to be tested on the particular platform for weight and balance and other factors.
That's absolutely correct. It's that integration of the system onto the ship that is really important and needs to be operationally tested. And the key thing with all of this testing is the testing will be for surface warfare will be completed in 2019. But what will the results show? Will changes be made, be needed on the seaframes to address some of the issues that came up in the testing? That's a big question mark still.
So in other words, they could mount a certain type of gun or missile launcher, say, on the aluminum hull. It could maybe rip loose when you try to fire one.
Potentially. I mean, that's really the point of testing, is to find problems and identify fixes before you continue to buy the asset. 2019 is still several years away, and that is the year that the Navy plans to buy its first frigate under its new approach to modify the LCS to be more capable.
So that would be a different version of the LCS, or is the LCS morphing into this frigate program?
Well, it's they're calling it a modified LCS. We actually have a separate report in the works that we'll issue in the spring to really delve into what is planned for the frigate, what's the acquisition strategy, what capabilities will it have, and so we plan to issue that report in March.
The overall mission, though, the Navy still is pursuing is close-in, close-to-shore, speedy, lightweight types of craft, whether they call it an LCS or a frigate.
Yes.
And in doing this latest report, did you talk directly with Navy officials and go aboard these ships, or was it an examination of other documentation that the Navy had already done?
This was a very comprehensive review. We, of course, talked to many different officials in the Navy on the acquisition side and the operations side. We visited the shipyards, we talked to the builders of the ships, we went on board the ships, and also spent quite a bit of time assessing the testing that had already been done by the operational test agent over at DOD, and determining based on what should be done when all the tests will be completed and what that means for the acquisition strategy for the LCS.
And seeing the ships in person, speaking to the builders and to the officers that might have to command them and operate them at some point, do you have a gut feeling that this program can eventually be made right?
I'm not sure a gut feeling is the key thing here. I think we would go back to the criteria, which is when you're investing a lot of taxpayer dollars into an asset like this, they should be properly tested before you continue to buy them. And that's really the bottom line concern we have that we've raised for several years now, is that the pace really needs to be slowed down or paused while you decide, while you determine what the test results will be.
And so for 2016, it looks like the Navy is at least in part taking that advice.
For 2016, they requested about $1.3 billion for three more LCS, and the Omnibus Appropriations Act approved that request. So it looks like they'll get three ships in FY16. Going forward is where the Secretary of Defense's recent memo called for the Navy to reduce the total buy from 52 to 40 ships and to down-select to one shipyard by 2019. So I think it's after FY16 where we'll see what the next budgets look like and how Congress decides to go forward.
Michelle Mackin is Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Management at the GAO. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Share this interview with colleagues and find a link to this report on the Littoral Combat Ship. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages. You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
Pentagon budget officials say they got 95% or so of what they wanted for 2016. In passing its omnibus appropriations bill, Congress plussed up the Defense Department by about $30 billion. What will it buy? I asked Rob Levinson, the senior defense analyst at Bloomberg Government. And let's start with what's happening in 2016. Just to review, the budget is finally there for real through September. $30 billion more than the spending caps, $30 billion more than they had last year. What does it all add up to?
Well, it's you know, they were worried that they were going to get back down at the spending caps, so the $30 billion is certainly a welcome addition. It's not quite as much as they wanted, and they will have to make some adjustments from the president's budget. But basically, DOD got most of what it wanted, and it can do what it needs to do with the money. It doesn't have to make huge adjustments to what the president originally asked for.
Now, there's a small gambit happening in the House where some Republicans and Democrats are getting together to talk about actually getting congressional authorization under the Constitution, I guess you might say, for warfare against ISIS. How does that interplay with the OCO, the Overseas Contingency Operations Account? And if that, it's a long shot measure, but if it were to happen, what would that do?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I mean, Congress has seen fit to, you know, sort of fund the wars without actually authorizing, which, you know, some people, the president has relied on the old authorization of use of military force, which happened after September 11th and was talking about Al-Qaeda. And a lot of people think that's sort of, you know, legally somewhat dubious. Even the president has asked for a new authorization of military force. But you have several sort of more hawkish members on the Republican side that want to, if they have one, they want a very broad authorization, gives the president lots of authority, because, of course, it will apply to this president, but the next president as well. And then there's others on the Democratic side primarily that would rather limit that. They still want to do it. People like Senator Tim Kaine, who's been pushing for this, Virginia, but they rather limit it. One of the things even the president said is, you know, perhaps we should have one, but it expires in 3 years. Not so much that we should end operations in 3 years, but the next Congress and the next president should have an opportunity to sort of weigh in on how we continue. So it's been very controversial. So they haven't been willing really to bring it up in the Congress, and they've been sort of letting the president go with the old authorization, and it hasn't really affected the budget at all.
All right, so getting back to that 2016 top line of $30 billion plus up, is it good for contractors, neutral, or should they still be looking for shaking the other guys loose?
No, I mean, I think it's generally good for contractors. You know, I mean, as we said, with the caps is the floor, that's sort of the worst case scenario. And this is significantly better than that. And I think most of the contract community, they're happy to have a budget. You know, we were on a continuing resolution, so that meant no new starts of programs. They're happy to have a budget. They got most of what they want. So generally, the defense contracting community is pretty happy with this agreement.
Now, the big program that's still on hold, not because of the budget, because of protest, which is now going to the GAO, is that bomber deal. So that could be a long time, months anyway, until we know what actually could be spent or what could happen there.
Right. It's the LRSB, the Long Range Strike Bomber, the Air Force's new bomber. And right, the contract was awarded to Northrop Grumman. Lockheed, Boeing, which is the other team competing, has protested that. So the GAO is looking at this. So it's going to be sort of on hold. And that's a huge, you know, multi-year, multi-billions of dollars, something like $55, $60 billion program. These aircraft are going to cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 million a piece. So it's a big
So they
fight.
Say now.
So they say now, right. The Air Force is really trying to limit the costs on this one. They're really trying to hold the line on that. We'll see how successful they actually are.
I guess balsa wood doesn't go up to 50,000 feet and stand up very well to heavy bombs.
Yeah.
All right, so the next big piece of news we might get then would be the 2017 budget request that is officially due the first Monday in February from the president. What are you looking for there?
Well, again, the budget agreement, which actually was signed between the Congress and the president, basically covers 16 and also sets the top line. So we know what the top line is for 2017 already, so they don't have to fight about that. But it's about $17 billion less than the president and DOD was envisioning for that year. And Frank Kendall, who's the number three, the undersecretary for acquisition logistics, et cetera, AT&L, he said what we're looking at is he said disproportionate cuts to modernization. Modernization is basically procurement and RDT&E, and he's probably going to be more on the procurement side, the actual buying of stuff. He's trying to protect the RDT&E budget. That's part of what we talked about before, Tim, the third offset. They want to, you know, that requires a lot of research and development. Although he said he expressed some concern that some of the research and development money was weighted too heavily towards the basic sciences, and he may want to shift some of that to more, you know, closer to actual operational systems. But, you know, he said like the F-35, which is the biggest Pentagon program, the new fighter jet, is not fenced off, and they're probably going to take a hit there because, you know, but they don't want to touch personnel. Of course, they've already cut personnel, so you sort of already saved money there. And the other thing that they don't want to touch is O&M because they feel there's a real readiness problem. And if you listen to all the chiefs of the services, they're very concerned about readiness, and so they don't want to cut into O&M. So it's modernization that's going to take the hit, and that is going to affect the contracting community.
Although these things are interrelated, I mean, what good is being ready if you don't have enough weapons, or if you don't have the latest weapons, then readiness is that much diminished also.
Well, that's true. I mean, you got to be ready, and you got to be ready to fight, but, you know, you can always, if you need to find money, you can push procurement program, basically, as you say, push them to the right, you buy a few, or... The other problem is it can be penny wise and pound foolish, if you will, because if they say, okay, we're going to buy fewer F-35s, so you save total money, but each one of the F-35s will cost you more because of the production rung. The contract will say, well, you're buying less, so the unit cost of the aircraft goes up. So maybe you save money in the short run, but over the long run, it's going to cost you more money for the airplane.
Plus, the ISIS deal, regardless of how it's authorized, is still operational. And isn't that putting a strain on the existing stock of aircraft that the Air Force has, at least in that region?
Sure. In fact, what it's really putting a strain on, and the Air Force came out and said this publicly, is munitions. They're basically running out of munitions. That they've been dropping so much that they need to replenish those stocks. And that's also procurement. I mean, you know, you've got to restock these ammunition, and they'll do that, and they may get OCO money to do that, but the Air Force, you know, they're going to get enough bombs one way or another to complete the mission.
So for 2017, will the same level of increase that happened between 2015 and 2016 happen likely between 2016 and 2017?
I don't think it's quite as big of an increase.
Rob Levinson is senior defense analyst at Bloomberg Government. Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click share with friends.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.